The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening.
I'm not running against crooked Hillary Clinton. I'm running against the crooked media. These are the most dishonest people.
When you can say something on television, you reach everybody at one time. There's something awfully nice. You call somebody a certain name and everybody hears it at one time.
Well, you know the voice, but the chances that Donald Trump will actually become president of the United States, those chances are becoming increasingly slim. Nearly every national poll and most of the important state polls have Donald Trump trailing Hillary Clinton, and he remains disastrously unpopular among non-white and moderate voters. Donald Trump has to find a way to convince somebody besides white males to vote for him. So it was confusing to a lot of people when this week Donald Trump named Stephen Bannon the chief executive of his campaign. Now, Bannon is known in media circles as the executive chairman of Breitbart News. That's an alt-right, often conspiratorial, often fringe conservative media site. Before he died, Andrew Breitbart, who founded the company himself, once described Bannon with sincere admiration as the Leni Riefenstahl of the Tea Party movement. Add to the mix Trump's new advisor, Roger Ailes, the former Fox News chairman who was ousted over sexual assault accusations. And from a distance, this does not look like a team assembled to impress the broad middle of America or win over moderates to get to the White House. But that's fed suspicion among media watchers and political experts that Trump may already be thinking about the day after the election, that in fact, he's put together the pieces to capitalize on the loyal and captive audience at his Make America Great Again rallies and monetize them into a new right-wing media empire. Joining me now is Sarah Ellison. She's a contributing editor with Vanity Fair. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm so glad you're here because everyone is looking at Donald Trump's new team and speculating wildly that he's cornering the market on a new right-wing media empire.
Right.
You reported all of this back in June.
Right. I mean, the thing that is interesting, that's interesting to me, too, in fact. And it makes sense, but it actually, there have been discussions about this. So this is not just something that we have all been thinking about in the media. This is something that Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have had conversations about. How would you monetize this audience? And what was struck me back when I was doing this reporting the first time around was that they talked about the electorate as an audience. And I think that is the main takeaway here, is that Trump doesn't distinguish between what an audience would be that you could actually monetize and what the political electorate is that would actually go out and vote for someone.
And at the beginning of this Trump campaign, so many people, and I will confess, even myself, strongly suspected all of politics to an extent is self-serving, but many of us suspected a truly self-serving effort from Donald Trump, that this may be about his brand and about business as much as the country, if you want.
Well, I think that I don't think this has been extraordinarily strategized or planned out by him, and I don't think that he operates in that way. I think that this is the kind of thing that once he started to get some success in his primary campaign, people around him said, well, could we make some money off of this? Because, I mean, one of the frustrations that I heard from people that I was talking to is that he says, I'm boosting the ratings of all these other news outlets. We're not making any money off of this ourselves. And for somebody who sees himself as a businessman and clearly sees that as a motivation, this is an obvious way to go. Now, the most convincing pushback that I've gotten on this is somebody who's pretty close to him said he's already figured out an easier way to make money, which is just put his name on things, whether it's Trump steaks or Trump shirts or, you know, whatever it is that he's licensing. So I don't know exactly how day-to-day involved he would be, which is why somebody like a Steve Bannon is so eye-opening to people.
So does that imply then that the recruitment of Steve Bannon, to those of us who are into politics, it does not spell the recipe for reaching the broad middle? Steve Bannon is not the guy that you would hire to try to get to the White House with the campaign in the state that it is in. Does that suggest then that Bannon is part of a strategy to identify and wall off the contours of this amazing audience that Trump might have and be able to go after them after the election?
I mean, I think that this is, I mean, certainly that's a logical sort of place to go. I think that what he's doing is conducting an incredibly savvy and successful media campaign. I mean, this is a media strategy, whether or not they're calling it that, because you need to have an audience that is focused and interested in your product. I mean, these are the kind of things media executives are looking at this and saying, like, if only we could get this kind of a dedicated audience that Trump has.
I just want to point out one detail from your story that I think a lot of people missed. It has this fantastical idea that Donald Trump discussed with executives at NBC potentially continuing a version of The Apprentice from the Oval Office if he were elected. We don't have to give up the show. You can still do this from the White House.
Yes. I mean, the idea was that you couldn't do it during the campaign because of the equal time laws. But once you were in the White House, it's a possibility. You could certainly do it from there. So then we really would be living in a sort of Truman Show reality.
So what do we know then, before we let you go, Sarah, about how accurately Trump has put his finger on this audience and what they might be worth? I mean, Rupert Murdoch and Fox News figured out some of this a long time ago.
Sure.
That part's not new.
Well, I mean, I think that when you look at this, I mean, people are also talking about the idea that Roger Ailes is sort of an unofficial advisor. He is, of course, the father of Fox News, and it's an older audience. And in fact, one of the things that the people on the Trump campaign said, what they said was that we identified something that even Fox News couldn't identify. So clearly there's a much more nativist, I mean, that's why Steve Bannon makes so much sense, a much more nativist kind of overtly angry group of people. It's smaller. It's smaller than what Fox News is doing, because Fox News is not just the most popular cable news program in prime time. It's the most popular cable program anytime. So Breitbart is still very small when it comes to in terms of that type of an audience. I think that he does have his finger on the pulse here.
Well, Donald Trump has perplexed a lot of people in the political world by bringing on a team in the closing months of this election that does not suggest a strategy that might win him the White House. But Sarah Ellison, contributing editor of Vanity Fair, has been telling us since back in June, if anyone is listening, that Donald Trump may have a media strategy instead. Sarah Ellison, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, with the possibility of Trump TV, a Trump network, who knows, on the horizon, another media outlet shutters its site. Just days after Univision announced that it was acquiring Gawker Media for $135 million, news came that Gawker.com will cease to exist beginning next week after 14 years of operation on the web. The news comes 4 months after billionaire investor Peter Thiel bankrolled a lawsuit brought by celebrity wrestler Hulk Hogan, who sued Gawker for publishing clips of his sex tape. The suit was initially brought in 2012 and settled this March when a jury awarded Hogan more than $140 million, and that bankrupted Gawker. Ed Claris is founding partner of Claris Law and a former general counsel for The New Yorker. He joins me now. Ed, welcome.
Thank you.
$140 million was a bankruptcy. Gawker still has assets. Of course, they were scooped up. But were you surprised that Gawker.com decided to go away?
I was. I was disappointed. You know, the Gawker.com has developed a reputation for being a good news site overall, with making some pretty significant, drastic mistakes over the course of the last few years. But to see a place like that go under is a sad, sad day, I think, for the overall media ecosystem.
So the mistakes we should just put on the table, because there's some schadenfreude involved in Gawker going away. Not only was the Hulk Hogan sex tape an issue, there was the outing of a Condé Nast editor for being gay some years ago, a decision that Gawker actually reversed and took down the story, said that they regretted going with that story. But what is this case to you? Is it primarily a case about press freedom? Is it about accountability being exacted on a gossip site that went too far? What's this about?
Well, I think from a long-term point of view, it's not just about showing 9 seconds of sex between Hulk Hogan and Bubba Clem's wife. It's not about that small issue. It's more about what does a case that resulted in a $140 million jury verdict do to the overall media ecosystem in terms of how they push stories. This is a privacy case, but it's a very scary little tale around what happens when you make people angry. And Peter Thiel is very angry, and he bankrolled this case. He was willing to spend whatever it took to take them down. Hulk Hogan.
We should add Peter Thiel, one of the co-founders of PayPal. That's where he got all those billions.
Right.
Yeah.
Hulk Hogan, obviously a very public figure who's made his living, you know, acting as a wrestler and as an actor. He's been very public about things that are incredibly private to other people. He's talked about the length of his member. He's talked about his sex life. He's done all sorts of things that would make you think that this wouldn't be as offensive as he said it was. So it's not really necessarily about that. It's about whether this is going to chill newsrooms around the country.
And a lot of people in the news business, of course, have cringed at the idea of a billionaire with an axe to grind coming after a media outlet because he doesn't like them and he can bankroll somebody else's grievance.
That's right. And I've been in many a newsroom where I've had to give newsroom advice, both at ABC and The New Yorker. And what happens is that reporters want to know, what does this mean to me? And they also want to know, am I going to be defended by this organization that I work for? And is this organization going to go out of business and will I lose my job? So they're going to listen really hard to this. And the message that they'll take away is, I shouldn't make people angry. And by not making people angry, there's a great chance that good stories won't be told.
All right. We don't want those reporters and editors. They should not be intimidated by this. I'll say that right now. So you've also sat in the room with publishers and owners and editors in chief and giving them advice. What's their reaction to this? They look at the bottom line as well. I hope none of those reporters in the end are actually intimidated. But what about their bosses?
Bosses are changing the way they look at news. It used to be that you'd have great investigations. The days of Watergate pushing the envelope and the Pentagon Papers, again pushing the envelope, are somewhat gone. When I was in the broadcast business helping producers make hidden camera investigations, there was a day in the late 90s when those were de rigueur. You wanted to see through the video camera what was wrong with a certain company. These days, hidden cameras don't exist really. Why? Not because there's been big judgments, but because there have been big lawsuits. Lawsuits scare newsrooms.
And people know it. So it might be going too far to say we're entering a new era, but are we, where intimidation or billionaires with the money to file big lawsuits are the new enforcers of media ethics?
Well, I don't know if this is a trend, but it could be. I think that Gawker and Denton really pissed people off. Not many people are around anymore to do so. You know, you look back on the days of spy and you look back on the days of ambush journalism. Journalism has gotten to be a lot tamer generally overall. It's all about volume. It's not about depth. And it's not about trying to bring down the big corporate greed or bad guys as much as others.
For whatever else Gawker.com was, gossip site, Disturber, definitely a piece of independent media that is now going by the wayside thanks to the efforts of a billionaire crusader. Ed Claris, founding partner of Claris Law, former general counsel for The New Yorker. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
The Department of Justice announced on Thursday that it's no longer going to be using private prisons to house federal inmates. Now, this is a week after an Inspector General report found that for-profit prisons did not maintain the same level of safety and security, that's a quote, as those run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Now, the population in private federal prisons is relatively small, but the news of the DOJ's decision sent private prison stock prices through the floor. Michelle Deitch is a senior lecturer with the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and School of Law at the University of Texas, Austin, and she's written and lectured widely about correctional oversight and prison privatization. Professor Deitch, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this move by the federal government to basically stop using private prisons, was this a surprise?
Well, it certainly is. It represents a major turning point in criminal justice policy in this country, and many observers think it was long overdue.
Well, the country is going through an era of prison and criminal justice reform. Prisons, jails, incarceration at all levels is getting a lot more attention now. So this seems to fit into an overall spirit of reform.
Absolutely. I think we're seeing the country take a serious look at mass incarceration in this country, and prison privatization is certainly a very important element of why we've gotten to the stage we're in right now.
Well, wasn't the point here that private prisons were supposed to do at least as good a job as federal government prisons or public prisons, but for a lower cost? I mean, that was the whole idea of contracting out these prisons, I don't know, 30 years ago when this became popular.
There were two ways in which the private prison industry sold this concept. One was improved performance and the other was cost savings. And as it's turned out, neither one of those was turned out to be true.
So why not? What's going wrong in these privately run public prisons? The report suggested that there were more instances of violence, more instances of misconduct, sexual and otherwise, more corruption. Why are they doing such a bad job?
The research has shown that most of the cost savings, to the extent that there were any, came from saving money on staffing. The private industry tends to pay officers significantly less than the public sector does. And as a result, you've got high turnover, you've got high vacancy rates and such. And all of that leads to safety violations and an inexperienced workforce, all of which lead to or contribute to violence and other problems in the facilities. Also, there's a lot of cutting corners when it comes to the provision of health care and addressing other safety needs, providing effective food services and medical care.
So the Department of Justice says it's not going to renew any of these contracts anymore, going to basically let these private prison contracts die on the vine. But this is only a small universe. Only about 10% of America's total prison population is in federal prison, and only 12% of that is in these private facilities. So I guess the real question is, what's happening in the broader world? What's happening in the states with state relationships with private prison companies?
Well, I think it's important to realize that the development with the Department of Justice only affects federally contracted and Federal Bureau of Prisons contracted private prisons. So it has no impact directly on state contracted private prisons or the Department of Homeland Security's contracts for private beds or the Marshal Service. We need to look to see what's going to be happening at the state level. Because there is such a move towards reducing mass incarceration across the country, state policymakers are looking for ways to reduce their prison populations. So many states are, in fact, looking to potentially end those private prison contracts because they are really the easiest target when it comes to reducing the number of people who are locked up. In Texas, for example, we've recently closed two private prison facilities. There's talk about another one closing, and it's potentially there are potentially more on the horizon.
And is it fair to say that states look to the federal government? Of course, it's not dictatorial in this sense, but for guidance, what the zeitgeist is in criminal justice, and they say, well, if DOJ has done this, this is the way the prison culture is going.
I don't know if anyone's going to be looking directly to what the Department of Justice did, but it will certainly spur a conversation in legislative halls around the country. I think that it gives new force to arguments that advocates have made for many years that these facilities are unsafe and that they're not saving citizens any money. So I think we can expect to see a lot of changes and debates and discussions going on about the future of privatization in this country.
You know, Michelle Deitch, that's interesting you say that because this is not the way this is supposed to happen, right? We have this idea of politics that big prison corporation lobbyists, they know the lawmakers, they know the staff, they're getting multi-billion dollar contracts. And that's just the way it goes. All of a sudden, it goes in the opposite direction. Not only is the federal government severing these ties, but it seems like the industry wasn't expecting it. Their stock price tumbled drastically when this happened. I mean, this is sort of the opposite of the way we think these things work.
Well, it really shouldn't be much of a surprise to anyone. I mean, news about problems in these private facilities is hardly news. It's been an issue really from the earliest days. And anyone who's been tracking the industry knows that problems of safety and security have been in the headlines for many, many years.
The Department of Justice begins to sever its ties with private prison companies that run some of the federal prisons in this country. And now the question is, will states be watching? Will states be following with their private prison contracts? Michelle Deitch, senior lecturer with the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and School of Law at UT Austin. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Well, Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The Olympics, of course, are winding down this weekend. Fall is just around the corner, and that means that television networks, from Netflix to HBO to TV itself, they're about to release a lot of new fall shows. You have a lot of streaming and a lot of catching up to do. Our culture reporter Melissa Locker is here to help us choose some of the best things to watch to get ready for fall.
Baz Luhrmann's new show, The Get Down, which takes us to the Bronx in 1970s as the hip-hop revolution is starting. And it's kind of the end of disco and the beginning of hip-hop. And the Grandmaster Flash is kind of starting these things called Get Downs. And it's a really, really fun show.
Don't push me to be who you want me to be. Nobody's asking what I want to be.
Show me what you got.
Shout is a DJ, we call conductor, because Shout is fantastic, so bad mother.
Period pieces are really popular on Netflix and other outlets right now. Does The Get Down really capture the mood of the time with music and style the way other shows like Stranger Things have done?
Yeah, I kind of feel like Baz Luhrmann has done a really good job. They've spent a lot of money to make sure it's really period appropriate. There's incredible costumes. The music is just phenomenal. And like you mentioned, Stranger Things, the music will probably end up getting released on a soundtrack.
All right, we're going to talk about Stranger Things in just a moment, but I watched High Maintenance in its first season. Now High Maintenance is kind of coming into the big time.
High Maintenance started as this pretty small web series between a husband and wife team who had some roots in TV. Like, the wife is the casting director for 30 Rock, and the show follows a pot dealer who goes around New York City and delivers marijuana to all of his customers. And it gives a little slice of life of all of his different customers as well as into his life as a pot delivery man.
You're wearing a dress right now. I can't pretend that you're not wearing a dress. You don't usually wear dresses, but you look good.
Oh. Thanks, man. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have another customer who cross-dresses.
Oh, you do?
Very frumpy.
Yeah, the taste in the community can be a bit patchy, you know?
Yeah.
It started as a web series. There are about 20 episodes online. And then coming in September, it's going to turn into a full-on HBO television show.
I sure hope that it keeps that kind of small, viral, spontaneous feeling that the big budget of HBO doesn't make it feel too contrived or too big. I really love that show. Now, Narcos was a big hit in its first season. It's coming back.
Yeah, I was actually a little surprised that Narcos was coming back just because I feel like the first season was a full story. And I'm really excited that it's back. The second season looks like it's going to be amazing because it has the same cast. They are tracking down Pablo Escobar, who has escaped from prison. And it looks like it's going to manage like to have all the same drama and just a whole nother season of it, which if it's anything like the first one, everyone will be binge watching the second it comes out, which I think is over Labor Day weekend.
Melissa, you mentioned Stranger Things, and the second season isn't out yet. In fact, the first season just got released a couple of weeks ago, but you had a chance to interview the band.
Yeah, so the band Survive was tapped by the Duffer Brothers, who created the series, to soundtrack the trailer originally, which they'd created a fake trailer for the show to pitch to Netflix. And when the series got picked up, the Duffer Brothers came back and said, please score the entire series. And when I talked to the guys, they said that the scoring movies had always been a dream for them. And so they jumped at the chance to kind of provide their crazy atmospheric synth music. It's very suspenseful, it's very lighthearted, it kind of does a little bit of everything, and it's a really, really natural collaboration between the music and the visuals that you're watching, and the soundtrack itself is really, really good.
Well, Stranger Things is definitely the hit of the summer, but it is far from the only show out there. Lots of new shows starting up, getting their second seasons, or changing networks come fall. Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and here for us at The Takeaway. Melissa, thanks.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The forecast in Louisiana calls for more rain. This is adding to the damage caused by what the Red Cross is already calling the worst natural disaster since Superstorm Sandy. 13 dead, 40,000 homes damaged, over 85,000 people seeking federal aid. Among the damage is Dockside Studio in Maurice, Louisiana, where a foot of water threatened to end the studio that's seen the likes of Southern music legends like B.B. King, Irma Thomas, Dr. John, even non-Southerners like Arcade Fire. They've passed through to record there, and now the water is soaked all the way to the walls. Of course, music defines Louisiana in its times of celebration, but it does also in times of tragedy and hardship like this one. Here's Cezanne Nail. She's co-owner of that very same Dockside Studio I just mentioned.
People have been calling and seeing if there was anything they can do to help. We had so many musicians come with their tool belts on and tearing out walls and carrying equipment and drying things, and it's just been a beautiful thing. They tell me that Dockside is their home away from home, and they can't stand to see it closed and soaking wet and in the condition that it's in. It'll work out in the end. People will be recording before you know it.
Well, that sense of tragedy but also optimism bonded through music is something that's well known to Dr. Michael White. His home was destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. White is a jazz clarinetist and a historian. He's also a professor at Xavier University in New Orleans. Dr. White, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you, and I hope that you're well. Can you try to give us a sense of what your community and what Louisiana is going through now yet again?
Well, you know, fortunately, at this point, New Orleans is dry. We've had a little rain, but we haven't had flooding. But we certainly identify with and feel for, you know, the people a bit north of us, because we know what it's like to have that kind of flooding and destruction and devastation. It's like a nightmare to have to even see pictures of that. We kind of relive it, what we went through and what other people in our state are going through.
And you were someone who lost so much from Katrina and wrote about it.
Yes, that's correct. I had a massive archive of musical memorabilia and books and videos and a collection of vintage instruments and things that came from jazz legends and music, notes, interviews I had gathered over the years. So that was really kind of devastating. But it inspired musical composition. I ended up writing a number of songs dedicated to not only the losses, but the spirit of New Orleans and the community after the storm. And we put that together on a recording called Blue Crescent.
You wrote one song called Katrina.
One of the things that people do in these kinds of disasters is everyone has a story, and you constantly tell the story, where you were, what your evacuation experience was, what you lost, what other people you know lost. There's a sort of collective sharing of grief and also just, you know, that experience. So I wanted to do that in music, and I wrote the song Katrina to try to recall the storm and have individual musicians tell their version of the story through their instruments. And we did that with a set theme, which was interpreted by each musician individually. And then there was an improvisation by individuals and then collective improvisation. But to tell you the truth, I can't listen to it, and I certainly don't play it anymore, because it certainly brings back that whole experience to me.
Jazz is so closely associated with New Orleans, at least in the minds of those of us who are outsiders, of course. But a lot of other parts of the state are suffering here. And it makes me wonder how the jazz tradition relates in other parts of Louisiana, up to Baton Rouge and all the other places that are suffering now.
Well, I mean, jazz, of course, you know, was centered in New Orleans from the beginning. And many of the important jazz musicians were from New Orleans. But we've had jazz musicians from other parts of Louisiana, but also very important musicians in other styles of music that were from Louisiana, in blues and Cajun and Zydeco and Creole music, rock and roll. So we've had very important musicians from all over the state. And we see those musicians at festivals, sometimes local festivals like our New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival or the Festival Acadien, or even internationally. You know, there are musicians like Rockin' Doopsie and others that I've seen more in Europe than I see in Louisiana.
Well, unfortunately, there is a longer history of these types of disasters, even further back than Katrina in Louisiana. There's this song, Louisiana 1927, Randy Newman wrote it, that maybe helps tell the story of the rest of the state a little bit.
Louisiana, they're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. Louisiana.
That's always an important anthem. They played it a lot after Katrina, and it was recorded and re-recorded by a lot of people like Aaron Neville, for example. But I think even though it refers to 1927, the Great Flood, I think it's just as important now of a song that reflects on what's going on currently. So I think, you know, we'll be hearing a lot of that song again.
Dr. White, I don't know. It just has to feel to so many people where you're from like an onslaught, just getting through something as terrible as Katrina was just a few years ago and then to have to relive it. I know we're talking about music, but it sounds like something that's just too much to ask of a lot of people.
Well, you know, it is devastating. And, you know, for many of us, the devastation of a storm like Katrina with all the loss of human life and property and, you know, so many aspects of people's personal lives, it is a continuous recovery process, and many people are not really back to a state of normalcy, depending on your individual situation and what you had to go through in recovery. But one of the things that's helped us a lot throughout the years with, you know, tragedies like Katrina and anything else, I mean, other social issues, has been our music and our musical traditions, which tend to bind people together, both families and neighborhoods and entire communities.
And there's no doubt there's going to be a musical response to this disaster.
Well, I'm pretty sure that, like in Katrina, musicians, especially those that are affected by the storm, will come together. They will be closer. Their music will be more passionate. And certainly tragedies like these inspire very powerful musical statements. So there'll be new compositions and songs, and I'm pretty sure.
Professor Michael White, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael White is a jazz clarinetist. He's a historian. He's professor at Xavier University in New Orleans. Well, here's something to take with you today. The extreme flooding we've seen this week in Louisiana is not that state's first struggle with water. In fact, Louisiana is the world record holder in receding shorelines. It's lost nearly 1,900 square miles of land, the size of all the land in Delaware in the last 80 years. So Louisiana's landscape is shifting, but cartographers have not adapted with it. And now there's this strange gap between maps and geographic reality there. The next time you look at a U.S. map, erase a lot of that southern Louisiana and replace it with an expanded Gulf of Mexico. You have to let go of the image of that perfect boot-shaped state if you want a real picture of our country. Louisiana does not quite look like that anymore. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. You can follow the whole show at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you have a great weekend. I'll be back on Monday and all next week filling in for John Hockenberry. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.